This is Bob Lang with the Oral History Project of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Today is December 3rd, 2009. This is the next session in the ongoing oral history interview with Frank Kustra from CALS. Frank, we wanted to talk today about the evolution of the college itself. You have made certain references to certain programs that happened here or there over your years of involvement, but I'd like to get some global observations from you considering your long tenure at the college and your movement up in the ranks as to how CALS has changed.
Okay. We probably touched a little bit on that in the last session. So the transition is going to be interesting, and I've got to find a good starting point. I joined the college staff, the administrative staff, in 1969. And my role at that time was really in the research administration. So I essentially ran the financial support functions to track our research funding. I think I mentioned in our last session, all of the extramural support, federal and non-federal, was reviewed by me.
Right.
I did all the compliance work. I did the Human Subjects Committee staffing. I put together the cost sharing that was required on grants. Mm-hmm. There's a cost sharing requirement for our federal hatch funds. Mm-hmm. So I reported all that. I did all of the administrative reporting to USDA on the hatch funds. And so, you know, if I look at what was going on then and what is going on now, the compliance requirements on the university has just led to an expansion of the administration. There's no way that we could survive, I could survive, or anyone could survive in today's accountability with one person doing that role. In fact, just if I just tried to count up who's doing what I used to do, mm-hmm. Essentially it's probably a staff of six.
Really?
So, and it's not because I worked that hard. Mm-hmm. Everything was just a lot easier then. We had in the college, I'm going to say, and this is all off the top of my head, today we have about 220 research and teaching faculty and about 40 extension faculty for about 260. Probably when I started, we had a faculty of somewhere around 350. So that is a monumental reduction in faculty staffing. If you measure our undergraduate numbers then compared to now, technically it's not that much different. We're probably running somewhere in the neighborhood of 2,300 undergrads. My guess is that back in those days we were, and that goes back almost 40 years, mm-hmm. we were probably in the 1,500 range. Mm-hmm. So that isn't a lot of growth over that time. Our graduate training was much, we had many more graduate assistants in those days than we do now. So graduate training has decreased primarily because of the tuition remission policies that have been imposed. The faculty, I mean, our faculty in those days worked hard, and we had a world-renowned faculty. And the faculty today differs, I think, from that faculty in the sense, and we've talked about this a little bit, the allegiance that they have is to their research. While that was an important factor in those early days, in reality, there was much more allegiance to the program and to the mission of the department, to outreach. We still have an outreach mission, but I think things today are much more dedicated to their field of science and their research laboratory. There's still a commitment to teaching. I don't think you can be a professor without really thriving on that student-teacher relationship, especially the students we have today. And that's another thing that's changed, you know, just rambling here. Today's student is in the upper 10%, maybe 9% of their class, or they just don't get into the university. In those days, and myself as an example, my high school education, I had no intention of going on to college. So while I think I said I stayed with the college curriculum, my intent really was to, I didn't know what I wanted to do. Well, I think I had a good background, as well prepared as I possibly could be, given the fact that I was not motivated to perform well academically. So by today's standards, I could not be a Wisconsin graduate. Now, that's really too bad, because there's a lot of students out there whose parents are alumni, and we face that every day, where someone that's a Badger alum cannot get their kids into this university. And that's a change that we've had to live with.
Is that a good change or a bad change or mixed? Because I hear this issue from, this is not the first time I hear this.
It's an unavoidable change. I think it's good and it's bad. It's unavoidable because the university, to meet resource reductions, staffing reductions, has been forced to cap enrollment. Well, if you cap enrollment at a certain level, especially with a university of this reputation, there you have to have a benchmark. You have to have a place to cut it off. And obviously, class standing is going to be where you look to set that yardstick. So you're going to take the best and the brightest. And if we could have a freshman class of 10,000 instead of 5,000, you know, that bar would go down significantly. But we've had to keep elevating that bar to the point where, you know, these kids are bright. The good thing is, I mean, that really provides the energy for a lot of our faculty now, especially the young faculty, who are challenged by these young undergraduates. Many of our graduates get a research component to their education. And that just drives that research engine all that much more. The downside is it's hard selling that to the state of Wisconsin. You know, as part of the system, the university system has a campus in every corner of the state. And of course, in all those corners are represented in the legislature. And of course, they champion their local institution. Madison, in many respects, is seen as the place where the elite go and maybe the prima donnas, I don't know, the ivory tower. Mm-hmm. And so even fighting the political battle has been tough. When constituents of a legislative district is complaining about the inaccessibility of Madison. So, you know, there's positives and negatives on that. And the reality is we have no choice.
Frank, let me, before I drop that, I'm going to ask you an unfair question. The undergraduates who are getting in now on paper look very good. Their standing is high and so forth. Grade inflation, of course, has affected high schools just like it has affected the university. And I just wonder, of the undergraduates who graduate now compared to when you were here, by the time they graduate, are they significantly, substantially better than when you graduated? Not when they come in, but when they graduate.
It's a tough question because I don't know I'm qualified to answer it. But, you know, I'm going to have a bias towards the old old regime. And, you know, my fellow students from my era were very successful people. Mm-hmm. You know, you stay in contact with a lot of these people, and they're all over the place. I think the School of Business promotes the argument that we have more CEOs now than out there in industry than any other university. Maybe there's an exception, Harvard or somewhere, but.
No, I see that too.
We're very well. These are people that came in during the time that I was here or later. So, you know, the talent was there.
Yeah.
I think the education is excellent. It's possible that the education might even be a little bit less than maybe what we had simply because you've got more or the same student body being taught by less. Now, we've had to adapt to that. That's another change, if we want to talk about change. In our college, a lot of the undergraduate courses are really taught by professional lecturers, mm-hmm. especially in the big courses in bacteriology, biochemistry, genetics. You don't have the professor really in the classroom in some of those disciplines until you reach your junior year when mm-hmm. you're starting to take the more advanced courses. In some of our more ag-related areas where we don't have quite the enrollment numbers, you still have the faculty in the classroom. And that distinguishes CALS from a lot of other divisions within the university. The other thing that distinguishes us, and this hasn't changed, is our undergraduate advising. We pride ourselves in taking care of our students. I guess we don't have as many to take care of. 2,300, if that's our undergraduate enrollment, represents what? 7%, 8% of the university undergraduate population. So, you know, it's a lot easier for us to put a faculty member in that role and maintain some real contact with our students. That's in other parts of the university, undergraduates don't see a real advisor. Maybe the big departments have a student coordinator position that is there on a full-time basis. But that's another change that's happened over time.
Do you know Walter Dickey in the law school?
Oh, yeah. Walter Dickey and I served on the committee that hired Darryl Bazell. I was on the search and screen committee that hired Darryl Bazell, and I think Walter chaired that committee.
Well, he did. The reason I bring him up is he was, I'm currently interviewing him.
Oh.
And he said in the course of the interview, he too is a graduate of this university, that he is appalled and disheartened that this land-grant university has become so inaccessible to the students in Wisconsin. And he's talking not only tuition, but number of spots. And it was just interesting to me. And so I just mentioned that to you, wondering if you would feel the same way.
I do, but again, you have a finite number of seats that you can fill. And the harsh reality is that you take the cream of the crop. That has really, that has helped our reputation. We're the jewel of the Midwest. When you talk about academic credentials and an academic standing to get into an institution, it's amazing. It affects our athletic program, everything. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm not in that area, but my best guess is that while some of our athletes get some special attention, we don't have the kind of abuses that I think occur in some schools who depend on a nationally ranked basketball program every year. I hate to think how prepared those kids are for the real world when they come out and find out they didn't stick with a pro team or whatever. My guess is they're not prepared to do much of anything. I think at least we prepare our people to succeed after college.
Frank, would you say the freshmen who come into Cal's every year, are the bulk of them still farm kids?
No. The subject of today's session is change. And if you look at the student body when I was a student, now I'm just giving you a number, so I don't know how much, how factual this is. It's pretty close. The gender distribution of the undergraduates in Cal's when I was here was probably 80% male, possibly even 90. Keep in mind that home economics is where the females were, which was part of our college, but it was a separate school. And I would say that 20% included home economics.
So home we ec were was part of Cal's?
Yes.
Oh.
Home ec was a school within Cal's until the divorce of Glenn Pound and Dean Marshall was the dean of the school of what then was home economics. And they had a falling out, and the school then became a separate entity. And while we still live next to each other, the program separated. Today, the Cal student gender split is, now again, I'm probably a couple of percentages off, but it's 55% female, 45% male. So there's been a big change. The other major change is that Cal's is predominantly a pre-vet, pre-med college. Half the undergraduates in biochemistry on the Cal side are really enrolled in a pre-med program. There are also students in biochemistry registered through Letters in Science. Mm-hmm. Most of the students in animal sciences came here in a pre-vet program. So a very large contingent of our students are really in some kind of pre-med program, either human or animal. That wasn't the case when I was around here. First of all, we didn't have a vet school when I was here as a student. And probably most of the pre-med students were really somewhere else in LNS, maybe some in CALS, but that student distribution has changed significantly over the years. So that's a major change.
Back when it was 80-90% male, was the focus of the college basically on farming?
Or farm-related, agriculture-related areas. I mean, dairy science, animal science, agronomy, soils, those were big departments in those days, horticulture. They're still big, but they're significantly less. The growth has come in landscape architecture, where we cap enrollment there. We allow 25 students into that program a year after going through a preparatory course. So we have 50 students, 25 juniors, 25 seniors. Horticulture has grown, but biochemistry, biology is a new major. We didn't have that major.
Oh, but you can major in biology in CALS now?
Mm-hmm. Yes. And that wasn't even a major. So you've got a lot of students coming into basically a life science major, very technical, very scientific. That wasn't the case when I was an undergrad. Major changes in that. Ironically, while there's been curriculum changes, we struggle with that. We're struggling with trying to be more visionary with our curriculum even now. Dean John is, prior to her departure recently, had our CALS curriculum as a major objective for the coming year or two, where we really had to look at, you know, why are we here? Who are we training? You know, how can we improve the education curriculum that these kids are getting? So the curriculum really has changed a little bit, but it hasn't changed as much as the student body. Now that's created enrollment shifts, and courses have had to adapt, where you either have to downsize or gear up to meet demand. But very interesting student enrollment dynamics.
Now, early in this discussion, you commented on the decrease in faculty, which appears striking to me. Mm-hmm. Where have the reductions come?
We've held serve in areas like biochemistry, some of the life sciences have kind of held serve on numbers. While they've taken hits, we've been able to replace them. The university several years ago came up with a funding stream called cluster hires. Mm-hmm. And we've been very successful in that. So while we've lost faculty in some of those areas, these cluster hires are being targeted in emerging areas of science. And obviously the life sciences is that. And so we've been able to kind of hold level faculty numbers. A lot of our production departments have taken serious hits. Food science, plant pathology, the agronomy, ag and applied economics have taken serious reductions, significant reductions. And then a lot of them came in the extension. In our heyday, we had 80 extension-based faculty, where now we have about 40. Mm-hmm. So extension cuts over the year really cut into that. And that's another change. Just the whole, if you want to call it a land grant, but the Wisconsin model was always seen as the best model as far as the integration of extension and research. And of course we had a time period that occurred shortly after I arrived here as a student where extension was split out as a separate entity. Mm-hmm. The cooperative extension function used to be integrated into CALS. The dean of co-op extension sat right in Ag Hall. Mm-hmm. Well, then when extension kind of, they called it the merger. Well, for us, it was a pulling apart. Mm-hmm. It was taking that co-op extension function and really merging it more under one administrative management with general extension. And that...
Now they're on Lake Street.
Now, and Lake Street, right. So, you know, Henry Algren was the basically an Ag Hall, and when all that occurred, that whole function moved over to the east part of campus. That was an interesting period and a difficult thing to adapt to, because we had an associate dean for extension who managed our ag programs, and he was always half in our college and half funded by extension. So a person that answered to two masters. And that created a lot of, tension when cuts were made. How did we do that? Their idea of where to cut didn't always match our idea. Farming changed over this time. I think we even mentioned that in a previous session, where today your farmer is a businessman. He's not like my dad, mm-hmm. who had 2 years of high school and mom ran the checkbook and he milked the cows. Well, now you don't have an extension agent visiting your farm. If you need information, you go online. Mm-hmm. So that whole outreach delivery changed during this time. So obviously they were cutting these areas and protecting some of the natural resource and some of those more service-oriented programs that they had out in counties. That created a lot of stress between our college and extension.
Frank, I hear a lot about extension, and I can never really get my hands around it for all the years I've been here, mm-hmm. understanding extension. But my sense is that various departments and colleges and schools used to be responsible for the outreach, and then that was all pulled away and put into a large center.
Yeah.
And a lot of people say that the net result was not as good. Is that true?
Well, I think these are people that are talking from their own perspective. I could see where people would say that. First of all, you know, when you live and change is hard for people to accept, but change is inevitable, mm-hmm. especially with the funding shifts and just programmatic shifts that have occurred. So, you know, was it better in the old days? I think it was easier to administer because there was a pure part of our college that was extension. Mm-hmm. We had faculty that were tenured in extension and not in CALS. Mm-hmm. They lived in the same kind of home. Funds were sort of commingled, but it was all part of our budget. When the merger occurred, and I sat on the budget committee with Glenn Watts and Harley Klages and Daryl Barth, and I, when they were doing this merger, we looked at how are we going to adapt the budget to accommodate this major change. And we came up with something called an interinstitutional agreement. And it was a very interesting process because you had sort of the financial people from the two sides sitting there deciding how they could do this, but you have fringe benefits that are funded out of some certain account. And so how was that going to be divvied up? And it was, we came up with this interinstitutional agreement idea. Well, that said that, okay, now what was in that process where we had to actually accept many of the faculty that were tenured in extension, now we're coming over to Madison, and they needed to be tenured at Madison, not, and so they had gone through a process totally separate from our own tenure procedures. And obviously, there are faculty that hold those procedures and those standards pretty high. And so it was a very difficult situation in some isolated cases for faculty to accept and grandfather people into these roles. But that happened. And so we got that settled. And then there was this agreement where every year Extension agreed that they would fund the ongoing costs over on our side. Well, that wasn't quite as simple as it sounded, because as they were facing cuts, they couldn't give us everything. And this was through the Walsh era. And Leo had to take base funds that were part of our research and teaching component and pick up chunks of our extension faculty because we just didn't have the money. Well, that further eroded the 101-2, which is the state teaching line, and the 101-4, which is the state research line. And where we didn't have enough 104 money, which was the state extension, we had to pick up 5 or 10% of one person or another. And so it never quite worked out quite as easy. There was, at the time of the agreement, there was an understanding that those would be covered, clear and simple, dollar for dollar. Well, that never happened. Things have equalized now. I think there's still an interinstitutional agreement, and there's still money that comes back and forth, but it's settled out. It wasn't like those early days where we had severe extension cuts and we just had to protect people.
Frank, I want to return to students for a moment.
Yeah.
Do you get, you said, when I asked about farm kids, you said no. You know, they certainly were not the majority. Do you, however, get kids who are interested in running large farms?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And they come in with that definite orientation.
Yeah. I would have to go back and see with our placement in our you know, we track these things, and that's not part of my role. Mm-hmm. So here again, I'm speculating. First of all, when I was an undergrad, we had a lot of farm kids come here. Mm-hmm. And they came here because we had the outstanding dairy department. We had the outstanding agricultural college in the country, and we still do. But our profile has changed to a more scientific, biological, pre-med, pre-vet med program. So we still have people coming here that are running large farms, and these are people that, first of all, are qualified to get in here, and second of all, come here with the intention of really getting a good business sense. So they're not only coming here for the ag component, but also the business component. A lot of the people that don't qualify in terms of academic standing go to River Falls and Platteville. And, you know, there's a place in those two institutions. And so I would say most of the real farm kids go to those two institutions and aren't here. Not like they were in the days when I was an undergrad.
And that fact is not necessarily a deliberate policy. It is rather Cal's adapting to the change in the culture.
Yeah. Having to adapt to the academic standards that the university sets. In all honesty, a lot of rural kids, myself included, I got up at 5:30 in the morning and milked 20 cows and went to school and came home and fed those same cows and milked cows and got into the had supper. We called it supper. even that's changed. Now it's dinner. And then we'd go out and milk the cows, and I'd get in at 7:30, and that's when I tried to do my homework. Mm-hmm. I was oriented towards that farm life. I think there's a lot of kids out there that, because of their commitment to the farm and the family farm, maybe they just don't have the time or the energy to put a lot into the academics. But when they actually graduate from high school, I think their option is River Falls or Platteville, because they just can't hit that upper 10%. I don't think they're any less intelligent. They have more demand on their time and more of a commitment to the family enterprise.
So does that fact that they're not getting into Cal's, is that detrimental to Cal's, do you think?
One of our strongest alumni programs are the Farm and Industry Short Course. We still have that program's celebrating its 100th year, this year, in fact.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and so we have a lot of our alums that are basically associated with that program, mm-hmm. Which is kind of interesting. Really creates kind of a dual alumni group, because obviously they're not committed to they feel an allegiance to the University of Wisconsin because they were here, and yet they never completed a four-year BS degree. Mm-hmm. That's an interesting situation. Now I've forgotten your question.
Well, my question was, is Cal's lessened in some senses by having a smaller and smaller percentage of the rural farm kids like Frank Kustro was 40 or 50 years ago?
Gosh, I think in some respects we struggle with that because we really, our dairy program, our undergraduate dairy program had really started to suffer. And it was largely because we couldn't, if the university made the admission decision, we were losing people that were technically qualified, mm-hmm. but didn't quite meet that benchmark. And so we actually had to work with the admissions people to take a look at those students that we knew were applying that were right on that edge. and try to give them a push to get them in. So while I think Cal's has suffered, because we've got to maintain a basic agricultural mission. Mm-hmm. It's very important.
That's your foundation.
That's our foundation, right. And the struggle has been trying to maintain that while still addressing the more life science growth that's mm-hmm. occurred in the life science areas. That's created a lot of tension with administratively, because grants bring in indirect costs, and the grants are overall, they're all over on the life science. Mm-hmm. And so in some sense, people argue the rich get richer and the poor get nothing. And whenever there's some attempt to be more, can I use the term socialistic, mm-hmm. where you move some of that money in to support the other programs, that creates tension. So yes, I mean, we have suffered, I think, as a result of this. One of the things that we suffer from is our name alone. There's a lot of people admitted to this university that still see our college as the farming college, when ironically, probably compared to the past, very few people go into farming mm-hmm. that come out of Cal's. In fact, our career paths are outstanding. Our placement record is outstanding. And we've had trouble even giving away some of our merit scholarships, because a lot of the urban areas really don't identify with our college. They don't understand our college. Mm-hmm. So we have that kind of stereotype that we're agriculture, and we don't want to go into that. Well, there's a lot of opportunities in agriculture beyond farming. So there's, I think we've suffered in those areas. One, in the area of losing a lot of farm kids. Mm-hmm. Some of our more applied sciences are suffering as a result of that. Although they've adapted, I mean, ironically, agronomy used to have dry labs when I started. You'd go into a dry lab, not a wet lab. All the agronomists we're hiring today are wet bench scientists. Hmm. So there's been a transition there too. And then the other area that we've suffered with is just holding on to that name, which we have to. I don't think we can give up agriculture. But the perception is that our students go back into farming, which is not the case.
So, Frank, that prompts me to ask you, I have to, about Michael Pollan and the growth of organic farming and the interest in food that permeates the United States these days.
Yeah.
And so you have that on one hand, and then there is the whole attention, pro or con, but corporate farming, Monsanto, Archer Daniels, Midland Archer Daniels, mm-hmm. You know, there is some public awareness of all of this without really able to conceptualize or focus on anything. Mm-hmm. Where is Cal's in all of this? And the faculty and so forth?
Well, we've adapted. And while I think people don't really understand that we're trying to adapt, we have to serve all of our masters. Mm-hmm. Our Ag Research Stations right now has a whole organic farming program. I mean, 10 years ago, we didn't even think about that. But now we have scientists, we have staff that are focused on some of these issues. And of course, the whole food and agriculture thing that erupted on campus recently created a lot of tension between those two sides. But we've lived in that world all along. You know, one of the things that was always an issue years ago is as the percent of our budget started to migrate towards corporate gifts, you know, the question is, you know, who are we working for? And can we truly be unbiased? Well, we like to think we are. We have protections. Actually, Wisconsin has policies in effect that go far beyond what other institutions have as far as disclosure of scientific information. We just don't enter into a contract where we give preferential access into intellectual property. But still, there's always that question. But we're adapting. We have organic programs out in our ag research stations. We have faculty engaged in that. We've always had that kind of stress. Our rural sociology department has always been holding us to a certain standard because they've been more maybe liberal and less conservative in certain areas like that. I don't know. It's been interesting.
What was the feeling at Cal's, I have to ask, about the chancellor's decision to bring Michael Pollan here?
Well, since no one will read this, I don't think we were very happy. We just knew it would create a firestorm. And quite honestly, the the administrative commitment it took during that period was unbelievable. I mean, we had two or three staff that worked 30, 40, 50% time just trying to deal with all the issues associated with that selection. Now, we didn't oppose it. We just knew it was going to create a lot of hardships, and we were called to answer the question, why was this selected? You know, whose idea was this? What's the college position on this? I mean, where do you stand on these issues? And these were organizations that we had a long history with. So we weren't real excited about it. We didn't oppose it, but we just knew it was going to create a lot of time and effort just to keep everything in balance. Interesting time.
Yeah, you know, I'm interested because of this movement in the United States now about food, and it's not just in Madison, it's lots of places.
Right.
People, consumers think they are attending to food by buying organic or not looking or looking on the labels and trying to make informed decisions, but it's my sense without really understanding the nature of agriculture. I certainly don't claim to.
Yeah.
And so I'm wondering how this national climate, if you agree with me that that is the national climate, is affecting a place like Cal's.
Oh, it affects us, yeah, it does. I mean, even in my own household, my wife, if she listens to some friends or even the news media or wherever she picks this up, she thinks she's gotta buy organic this and organic that. And of course, there's a price associated with that. And I'm saying, hey, you know, that, in my opinion, the other product is probably just as good, if not better, at a reduced cost. So what's the big deal? You know, we're not feeding you germs or anything. So there's a, you're right. I mean, thinking every household, this is an ongoing issue. There's a lot of very successful people dealing with organic farming. And that's a major revenue source in this college, with this state. So you go with the flow, I guess. There's a market for everything.
Yeah, it is. It's interesting to me. What little I read is that there are some organic truck farmers who are practically coining money, mm-hmm. as they say.
Yeah. Well, we have such an abundance of the food, good food. I guess if someone wants to adhere to a market that refuses to use any of the productivity enhancements that we've found out through spraying and fertilizer and various cultural things, fine. I think what we're seeing is where years ago we had an emerging industry with this organic farming business, and there was a real battle, almost where these people couldn't be in the same room. We have to operate on both sides of that ledger. And that's not our job to profess one over the other. Our job is to try to make as much information as known as possible with research. And it's interesting that these groups are starting to realize they can live together. There's a way that each side can succeed, and there's probably good points on either side. We're actually talking to both sides, and I'm not so sure that that was always the case. I don't know. I don't have to worry about that because I'm crunching numbers, but
but you surely would be aware of it.
Aware of it, yeah.
Now, Frank, what about during your tenure at the college? About fundraising and private money and the source of that and individuals and organizations and corporations. What has that meant to the college?
It's meant a lot. And when Dean John got here from Cornell, she said, you aren't even in the game. You are so far from where you should be with fundraising and development. She saw that as a real opportunity. And maybe she's right. But we're not the business school, and we're not the med school. And we have people that have been successful, we don't have the kind of alumni base that's going to drop $20 million into our pocket for a building. Mm-hmm. But it's meant a lot. And I think she sees, and maybe we see this as an opportunity to do more.
From the business world or from individuals?
Both. From both the business side and individuals. We're engaged in a lot of things today that we really weren't doing years ago. So I think we touch more people. There's a lot of rich people that are, let's take organic farming. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people that have, with a lot of money, that might have said, this is something that I really want to promote. And so while they didn't have a degree in agriculture, they look at some of the things we're doing and they really want to support that. Mm-hmm. So there's probably a lot of prospects out there where we could do more. Mm-hmm. But it's meant a lot to the college. right now, I'm going to take another stab at a general number. I think when I started in this business, the state component, we used to talk about we're no longer state funded, we're state supported, mm-hmm. meaning that the majority of our funds came from outside sources, either gifts, grants, federal money. So I would guess that our state budget represented maybe 35-38% when I started. Mm-hmm. Today, our state budget's about 17% of our budget. Mm-hmm. So from a percentage basis, look at how that's dwindled down to. And that includes tuition. I mean, tuition gets wrapped into that as well. So that's our tuition increases are in that 17-18%. So there's been a lot of growth on the federal competitive grant side. Mm-hmm. As I've said before, I continue to be amazed at how successful our young faculty are at getting money. Mm-hmm. And they're dedicated to their research, and that's good. We also get a lot more money these days from our development programs. And hopefully there'll be more. The downside of that is that, well, you guys have other pockets you can dip into. So I think education has taken a hit because we can raise tuition. Mm-hmm. We can go out and raise money. I serve on the campus planning committee, and we had a meeting. We had a meeting this morning, and Alan Fish's staff presented a 20-year summary of the capital projects and
what's coming in the next 20 years?
The past 20 years.
Oh, the past 20 yeah. years.
And there's $2.8 billion in buildings over that 20-year period. And $780 million of that is state-funded. The rest came from private sources or program revenue, like the athletic department, when mm-hmm. they can fund program revenue bonds. So, interesting that really, that's an amazing statistic to have $2.9 billion and only $700 million of that is state-funded. Mm-hmm. That's what our development program is meant to, the capital side of things. Mm-hmm. And it's meant a lot to our operating budget as well. Mm-hmm. We don't get any operating funds from the state anymore. Most of our departments have, in a budget cut, the first thing they cut is their operating funds simply because they're trying to protect staff. And they're pretty much depending on what I'm calling outright gift money to run their programs. It's really sad.
Frank, does the college have an independent relationship with the legislature?
No.
There must be the legislators who are particularly interested in the work of CALS.
Oh, yeah. But, you know, if you talk about change, remember we talked a little bit about Glenn Pound. Glenn Pound, I mean, he had the Ag Coalition in his hip pocket. And all he had to do to mobilize anything was make a phone call, and that was it. Mm. Two things have happened. Agriculture, while it's still a major economic driver in this state, doesn't have anywhere near the power that it used to have. And secondly, your legislators have their own university in their backyard, mm-hmm. and they have very little allegiance to Madison and our programs. So while we have an associate dean for external affairs and we do a good job of staying in touch with our rural legislators, representatives and senators, it's not nearly what it used to be, not at all. And we can't afford to get crosswise with the university in these matters either.
I wasn't suggesting that.
No.
I was just...
Well, in the old days, I don't think we cared about the university. Because, as I said, Glenn could make a phone call, and there wasn't anything the university could do about that. Mm-hmm. But that's changed. Well, it's very, very interesting. Very, very significant changes from the past.
And what do you think about that, Frank?
I think it had to happen. I don't see it any other way. I don't like everything that happened. I think our extension program suffered with that change. I think to some extent our student body, I think we had much stronger alumni relations when we had a more ag student body than we do now. We still have a strong alumni group, but our WALSA, our alumni group, has been fairly static over the years. I think you see more and more of our grads really joining WAA. And maybe we've hung on to our old alumni, organizations too long. Every college has its alumni group, but we were always different. We had people that were members of WALSA and would never think of joining the Wisconsin Alumni Association. Mm-hmm. And I think that's changing now. And more people are moving towards the campus level alumni association and not joining the WALSA. So what do I think of it? If you're going to just sit and think about how good the old days were, I think you're living in the past. Mm-hmm. You got to move forward. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think a lot of the changes has been good. I think there's the new dean, Molly John, had a vision for redirection that I think was needed and ambitious, merging departments, trying to create a sort of a critical mass. When you have a department that's down to 6 faculty, you just don't have a critical mass anymore. Mm-hmm. And so her vision was to try to reshape and reprogram. A lot of our departments have made name changes to kind of show that they've adapted. In reality, they just changed their name. That's not to say they haven't evolved slowly, but I think her vision is that we need to make some massive change to stay on top. So change is good.
Now, what does that mean, Frank? Massive change.
Well, I think she wanted to create where we have 20 departments right now because we just merged wildlife and forestry. Oh. I think her vision was more like 12.
I see.
And major restructuring of our curriculum, major restructuring of our direction. Don't ask me to explain what that might be.
Right.
But I'm trying to remember. Molly was very articulate. Man, she was just a visionary person, and most of the time she was right on. It's just that change doesn't happen that fast. You've got to bring people along, and you just can't turn things upside down and expect to survive. You've got to work at it gradually. But she was trying to reorient us, where she's not turning with it, where they say you can only turn the ship 1 degree at a time.
Yeah.
I think she was focusing more on 10 degrees. So what do I think? I think the change has been good, and we need more. I think we need to take a hard look at where we're going and who we're serving.
Yes. And does identification of who you're serving and the hard look continue to find its footing in agriculture?
No. It continues to find its footing in the biological sciences, which agriculture is a component of that. I mean, agronomy, horticulture, all those things are biological.
Mm-hmm.
But if you want to look at just the more traditional agriculture, I think we need River Falls. You know, there was a lot of talk about, why do we need 3 ag schools?
Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe we don't need 3, but we need 2, because we're not going to serve the people that's a whole different group over there. And the hard part of it is we need those people to support us. And sometimes those people don't understand the research that goes on here, because they've come out of a very applied program.
Mm-hmm.
And
we have Platteville and River Falls that have the ag schools.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But we can't sustain an ag school like they do. Our ag school is much different, much more biological.
Mm-hmm. And it would be your guess that it will continue in that direction, ever more so, perhaps.
Right. Yeah. I think you're going to have to see trying to remember the last new department that we had. And I can't remember in my entire time here. I can't remember landscape architecture. At one point, landscape architecture was a part of horticulture.
And there was some split or
something
angry, wasn't there?
Well, that was within the department. That's when half of them moved to Urpil. But landscape was a program within horticulture when they got departmental status. So that's one department. And I don't remember exactly when that happened. I think that happened before I came here in 69, probably in the early 60s. The Food Research Institute got departmental status, but they were an institute when I arrived, and then they became the Department of Food Microbiology and Toxicology, and now they've merged into bacteriology. So if you look at program redirection, we haven't had any new departments. But we've had departments that have folded back into a larger unit. Wildlife and forestry, food microbiology and toxicology and bacteriology, those are 2 that have merged recently. And I think you're gonna see more of that change in the next 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know what the titles will be, but they'll be much different titles than what we have now.
And the college, I'm inferring from what you say, will become an ever more sophisticated research institute.
I think so.
Mm-hmm. What will that do to the teaching component of the college?
It's hard to say. You know, we used to have professors that were, their profession was animal husbandry, taking care of animals.
Mm-hmm.
We don't hire those people anymore. So the teaching is going to have to adapt to our student and to, you know, to our, to the stakeholders that we're, I mean, we provide a human capital to the state of Wisconsin, to the U.S., to wherever these people go. You know, we're meeting that need. River Falls is meeting the need of putting out a human capital to what I'm calling mid-sized farms, maybe some large farms. I don't think many of our students go back into anything less than a corporate farm. Mm-hmm. Some probably do, but I don't know. Certainly not as many as we used to have.
And does the college itself have a position on the future of family farms?
Oh, yeah. There's where we have to keep one foot on either side of the ledger. First of all, most family farms today, this was more of an issue when we had a lot of small farms. Mm-hmm. We don't have many small farms anymore.
Small meaning the size of your parents?
Well, even, let's say, 50 cows and below.
50 cows.
Yeah. You know, you've got even farms that probably are milking 100 to 150 have incorporated in some way, either as a limited liability corporation or a family partnership, because you just can't, you need labor. And if the labor's family, you've got to kind of protect that. So the whole organizational structure of your family farm has changed. It's still family, but you're now a partner or a shareholder in something where you used to just all work together. So that's really changed. That whole dynamic has changed. We don't have that kind of pressure anymore. I think we always used to have a lot of critics that say, well, when Weiss came in here and was promoting a 1,000 cow herd up at Marshfield.
Right.
Oh, my. We heard it then. You people are, you just want to support, you know, 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 cow operations, and you've forgotten about us. Well, that wasn't true at the time, and it will never be true. But I think people realize now with the corporate farms that are out there, we're still directing our programs at family farms, but they're all mid-size now compared to what I considered to be large farms when I was working with my dad.
Do you think part of the American fascination with organic farming is the assumption is that these are sweet, and I'm not being pejorative, small family farms?
That's some of it, but I mean, as soon as this caught on, I mean, we have large organic farms now. Mm-hmm. I mean, it didn't take long for people to understand, you know, we can make money here, and they moved into that big time. But I think that was an issue maybe early on where it isn't so much anymore. I just really enjoy the love affair that this community has with the farmers market. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's fantastic. Mm-hmm. Whenever we have people come to town, we always have to take a Saturday stroll up at the farmers market, and they're just amazed at that. Now, that I think is still people supporting the small little local guy. But if you shop at Whole Foods, I don't think that you're thinking that you're supporting a little guy. I think you know you're dealing in the corporate world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Ask you to do that.
Yeah.
Frank, as you think about the college and the evolution of the college, clearly the various deans have had a major role in where the college is going. And you've been here for a long time. Any observations on the deans you've worked with?
Yes. And I've worked with some great people. And I've been able to see them from the inside.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, just working with him chronologically, I didn't know Froker when he was dean. He was here when I was an undergrad. If you're an undergrad, you go see the associate dean for undergraduate affairs, and I think I told you a little bit about Dean Kivlin. But when I started with the college, Glenn Pound had been in the chair for 3 or 4 years, and Glenn was an outstanding administrator, very decisive, very much in control, ran a very efficient shop, operated in a day where there wasn't a lot of bureaucracy, was, I think, one of the finest administrators that I've known. He later was brought up to Bascom Hall and served in sort of an interim role. And so my good friend Art Hovey had a chance to work with Glenn. And I think Art shares my opinion that Glenn was an outstanding administrator.
What does that mean, Frank, when you say an outstanding administrator?
He just, one, he let people run their own shop. So he didn't get in their way. If he heard something that he didn't like, he had you in and talked to you, but that was it. So he did not micromanage. He did not have a big staff function where he brought everyone together to sit around the table and chit-chat. He had a very select people that he dealt with on a one-on-one basis. And he managed the external affairs of the college. So, I mean, that's what I really liked about Glenn and how he ran things. I don't think Glenn could survive in today's world. Yeah, I mean, it was just different then than it is now. And you just answer to a lot more people. And people are much more challenging than they were. I mean, Glenn had operated in a time where he had enough control over the situation that he had more power. And I don't think administrators today have that kind of position. They're more diluted. They just have to serve more masters.
Frank, was Glenn a farm boy?
Yes, he came from Arkansas. I don't know his rural upbringing. I think he was a farm boy. He was educated in Arkansas. Was a plant pathologist. Did all of his own field research. So, yes, I think, I'm not sure if all of our deans were farm boys, but most of them probably were, yeah. Glenn then handed things over to Leo Walsh. Leo was an extension soil scientist. Leo was dean for 14 years. I was never Glenn's finance guy. After a few years, I think we talked about, Glenn brought me in as his finance person. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, Leo. Leo kept the old person there for a while and then brought me in when Bob Hughes retired. Leo had a lot of vision. He was our international dean. He had that vision and really wanted to carve out some resources to rechart a new course, to invest in new areas. And every time he tried to do that, we had a budget cut and he lost it too. But I really thought Leo was... had a lot of vision and was really trying to move things in different directions. Leo's problem, he was never accepted as the strong science that this campus adores. Mm-hmm. He was seen as an extension faculty person. He was never accepted totally by Bascom Hall. So he just had a strong current to swim against his whole deanship.
When you say Bascom Hall, are you referring to the then chancellor?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that would be Shane?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They never got along, I don't think. And I don't know exactly why. Part of it was this China trip. And they
yes,
went on that China trip. I think things happened on that China trip where Irv saw Leo in a social setting and just didn't think he had the charisma and the suave nature that maybe others might have had. I don't know, but I did like Leo, and he was really trying to move in another direction. Then, of course, Roger Weiss came in, and for as many problems as Roger had, he came into a situation where he had kind of a CEO attitude, East Coast mentality.
Not a farm boy, I'm assuming.
Not really a farm boy. Thought he was the answer to management by objective and all that sort of terminology that was going on at that time. Just really stubbed his toe with coming into Wisconsin with the demands he was making on for his spouse, housing, a lot of things that just didn't go well. And
was he a Donna hire?
Yes. Yeah, he was a Donna hire. Where Donna had hired a lot of deans, a lot of them didn't make it.
Right. That's why I asked.
Yeah. But I'll tell you what, Roger inherited Leo's budget problems, which, as you know, we were at the bottom of the well,
mm-hmm.
and that was the time where I got out of Dodge.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And Roger came in and got things going the right direction. And I don't think people ever will give him credit for that because of all of his personality and his other issues. But he got the budget straightened around. So when he left, it was back on the right track.
That's very interesting, Frank, because while I was not close to Cal's, my sense was that Roger Weiss was an unmitigated disaster.
Everyone you talk to will say that.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
And in many respects he was, because he just never understood us. He never really knew who his people were. And he had his own little private problems.
Uh-huh.
But everyone said he was a disaster, and they would tell you to this day he was. But Roger fixed things.
That's interesting.
He fixed things. And we lost the School of Vet Medicine, or the Department of Veterinary Science, over some of his cuts. And that was unfortunate, because I think that was a mistake. And maybe he didn't handle that the best way, but he fixed the budget, and I will always give him credit for that. Well, then Neil came in, and if there's a guy that held the college together during its worst years, it was Neil Jorgensen. And there's no finer person and more a person that's had more of a responsibility for who we are and how we got here than Neil Jorgensen. He was Roger's deputy. He suffered through that whole era. And to some extent, he stayed here simply because he was loyal to the institution and tried to carry that, to the point where the faculty went up to Bascom Hall when he was made interim dean after Roger left, and they asked the chancellor to give him the title dean, remove remove the interim from his appointment.
Oh.
And so he became probably the only dean that we had that was never openly recruited.
Oh, so Ward did that?
Ward did that, yeah. And that was really good. And then Aberly came in. Aberly was a farm boy from Nebraska. I think he grew up, he was educated in Michigan State. I don't think he was from Nebraska, maybe, but the Midwest somewhere, a farm boy. And he was the department chair for the animal science program. Abe brought the stability. I mean, the place was just in turmoil.
Well, how long did Neil serve as dean?
Probably about a year and a half.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it was just that interim period in there. And then Abe came in and reestablished the connection with Bascom Hall. I think Roger had a good connection with Shalala, but Ward and Wiley didn't like him. Once Shalala was gone, his protection was gone. And Abe came in, and I think he built bridges back with Bascom Hall. And Abe was a good staff level dean. He was in an era now where he really needed a strong staff around him, and he used them well. And then, of course, when Abe left, then...
Did he go to another school, or did he retire?
He retired. He retired here. When he came, he said he was going to retire at 64, I think, and he did. I mean, it was 64. So he just said, I'm here for 7 years, and I'm out. And he did that, and he's still around.
Oh, he's still in town?
Yeah, and he has an emeritus office. And when he left Ag Hall, he did not poke his nose back into things. He said it's time for someone else to move in. Dave Hogg was the executive dean at that time, so he became the interim for 1 year until Molly got here. And Molly, all I can say is I've never seen a person with as much energy and as much vision as she has. Just a fantastic person. And to sit and listen to her talk and where she is so articulate and where she wants things to go and why we should go in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
If she had a couple other attributes along the way, she would be a fantastic dean. And maybe she can develop into that when she comes back.
Not socially skilled, I take it?
Molly never held an administrative position prior to taking the dean. She moved from a faculty role.
Wow.
Our fear when she became dean was that she really didn't understand staff and staff functioning. And I'd have to say our worst fears were
confirmed.
She had a small group that she met with, but she just really frustrated them in many ways. I could never be sure that you learned after a while when you listened to her talk that if you were around very long that you really didn't know if you were hearing the truth or it was a quibble or I always got the impression that when you weren't in the room, something else was being said, because so often things changed where we would be going in one direction and then after she talked to somebody else, we'd be going in a different direction. It seemed like her decision-making was to move too fast without really absorbing all of the information and then making a hard choice on where to go. And I think maybe if she gets to Washington and starts to function in that environment a little bit, some good things will rub off, and if she comes back, she'll be able to pick up where she left off and really have a better appreciation for how to go about moving in certain directions. She always wanted to go too fast, in my opinion, and maybe that's the way to get change, but I think she just lost too many people along the way.
Do you hope she does come back?
No. I don't. Mm-hmm. I hope she stays out there. I just think it would be very hard for her to come back.
Mm-hmm. How long was she deemed before?
3 years.
Just 3 years? Mm-hmm. So she made a pretty strong impression in a pretty short time period.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, an amazing woman. Absolutely amazing. But I wanted to say something nice about all those deans, because you don't get to be a dean unless you know what you're doing. Mm-hmm. And while each one had his or her strong points, you could probably, in any person, myself included, point out a lot of faults. Mm-hmm. The important thing is that they're the people that are hired to do the job, and if your job is to support that person, you do so. That's the way it's supposed to work. But there were some really great people. I don't know where we're going now. You know, as I look to the future, Molly was an agent for change. And when I say I hope she doesn't come back, others might disagree, because I think there's a lot of change that has to occur in our college. And something's got to be happening in the next 5 to 10 years. Mm-hmm. Just to keep pace. So where is that leader that's going to take over? We have an interim dean now in Erwin Goldman. I think Erwin would be a good choice.
Where is he from?
He's from horticulture.
Horticulture.
Yeah. So, and I think he's demonstrated a strong listening ethic, has a good sense about things. So, Erwin is a possibility, but I think we also need change. So we'll see what's going to happen.
But Frank, you've made reference to Cal's being the jewel in the Midwest. Is the UW-Madison's College of Agricultural Life Sciences still preeminent in the United States?
Absolutely. We have more scientific sites. You know, it's people look at what's going on here. Mm-hmm. Our research publications are cited more often than anyone else. We have more patents and intellectual property than anyone else. We have more extramural support awards than anyone else. For our size, and we're not as big as many. I mean, mm-hmm. Illinois, Minnesota, Michigan State, they're all much, they have much larger faculties than we do.
Really?
Oh, yeah. But we just run circles around. There's no doubt that we're still on the top of our game.
Mm-hmm. And you would anticipate that that will continue?
Yeah. I think the secret to our success is, first of all, war funding, how we distribute our hatch funds, the
yes.
competitive nature of that, and the fact that we don't accept anything less than the absolute best. We don't fill a position just because we have a PVL out there and we're not anxious to fill it. We can have searches that go through 2 and 3 postings before we find the person we want. And
really?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That's biochemistry's secret to success. They will not, if they're not absolutely satisfied that they've got a real star, and we don't succeed on all our hires, but I bet you we succeed on the majority of them. And we just will not fill a position unless we know we've got the best of the best. And that's why we're up on top with research funding.
Mm-hmm.
These are talented people. To some extent, I think Madison, Wisconsin is a draw. Maybe people look at Madison as being sort of the middle of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
But in reality, this is a great place to live and to raise a family. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a draw.
Mm-hmm.
We always said the Lake Mendota factor was worth $5,000.
Yes, I heard that that was Dave Cronin's
right.
argument
right.
quite a bit.
Right. Yeah, the Lake Mendota factor. Anyway, I wanted to say something about each of the deans, and we've had a lot of very good ones.
This now concludes the December 3rd, 2009 session with Frank Kustra.